This is 91.5 FM, WOBC, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I am Mike the DJ. The name of my show is The Fluter Is Now, where I have music of and interviews with some of the top flutists around these days. Today, I'm very happy that my special guest is Nicole Chamberlain. We're going to have an interview with Nicole Chamberlain, along with some music that Nicole selected. I hope you enjoy.
Yeah, I am a composer and flutist, Nicole Chamberlain, and I live in Atlanta, and I'm basically a freelancer. I'm not associated with any institution or orchestra. I just kind of do my own thing.
I was going to ask you about that because I know that you are both a composer and a flute player. In your mind, does one take precedence over the other? Are you a composer that plays flute, or are you a flute player that also composes?
I'm a composer that has to play flute.
Okay.
Because in the beginning, you know, I think I needed to promote my own music. So It became a necessary evil. I love playing. I prefer people play my stuff instead. Okay. You know, I think it's, I'm lazy. And so writing always takes precedence. I will do that first before I would ever practice.
Gotcha.
In my natural day. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What are some of your earliest musical memories or experiences?
My big sister probably has a lot to do with that. She's 10 years older than me. I have two older sisters. I'm the youngest of three. So because there was a little bit of more of an age gap, I got to experience music firsthand because of her journeys, which was playing clarinet in the high school band. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time I had been to live music was her Christmas concert. Mm-hmm. So I was about nine. No, I was younger than that. It was first grade. So it was like I was six or seven. You know, I couldn't understand how that all coordinated. Like, I couldn't wrap my mind around it. And so I think Sleigh Ride stuck with me mm-hmm. as a child, you know. And I think that's kind of funny because the thing that I integrate in all my music is extended techniques, and Sleigh Ride has, you know, the horse at the end.
Right.
And so it's just kind of interesting how that has always fascinated me from the very beginning. And so, you know, my oldest sister, Galen, played clarinet. She taught me how to play reed sheet music. She taught me recorder. Mm-hmm. She taught me clarinet for the first year until I got over the reed situation. Kept breaking. I wasn't responsible enough. Mm-hmm. and then my middle sister had piano lessons, and I was always a tag along for that. And she hated it, and I loved it. And I think by the time my parents got to me, they gave up trying to push music. Right. And that tactic actually worked. Just let me do my own thing, not badgering me about practicing, not just letting it go. And they would only cave until I annoyed them about lessons or about, you know, playing flute or any of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why did you start playing the flute?
We lived in, at that time when I started playing more seriously, I guess as serious as a 12 year old can, we lived in Savannah, and the only music shop was about 30, 45 minutes away, and it's before internet. So my parents weren't about to order. So, you know, if I broke a reed, it would take a long time for mom and dad to make it out to the music store. And there was a flutist at our church who played with the local symphony. She subbed with the local symphony. She was great. She's wonderful. And I couldn't figure out how you made the sound, how that worked. Like, there was no visible mouthpiece that you put in your mouth or you pushed up against your face. And that interest led me to want to figure out how to do it. And then there was no reeds, so I'd never had to worry about that.
Right, there you go.
Yeah. And so that was why I am the way I am, I guess.
Makes sense.
And why I picked flute. Yeah.
Makes sense. What was your musical education then from when you decided to play the flute on until now?
I took lessons, but you know, I think much to my parents, they were worried about that. It was, you know, it was like my other sisters never followed through with it, and I was in band, but my band director, Michael Hutchinson, who's still a big influence today, was pretty adamant about me taking lessons. Like, there's only so far I could get just doing it in band, and he pushed really hard. He was tough as nails. It was a combative relationship, I think, between him and my parents and me. At the time, I wasn't his biggest fan. But later in life, I find myself spewing the same things he said, and we have been in contact since recently. But it's you know, I took lessons from a couple of the Savannah Symphony players as they rotated out. It was first Donna Orbovich, who later went on to Hong Kong Symphony, and then Lisa Winold, who now teaches, who's in the principal of the Alabama Symphony. Went to school, went to college. I went to University of Georgia, where I actually majored in composition, but took with Ronald Wallen there. And composition lessons with Dr. William Davis. So that has been the extent of my formal training, and then the rest of it has been, you know, and Dr. Davis was like, you should go on to get your master's. And I just looked at him and I was like, are you crazy? Have you not witnessed the past 5 years where I have struggle bussed through every assignment and every class? Like, school is not where I flourish. But I had another degree in digital media at that point. So I did web design as my day job until I was able to quit about, I guess it's been about almost 12 years now.
Your high school band director, what was something that he said back then that you hated that you've come to love now?
It was my middle school band director. One of the things that sticks with me, and I think has been very integral in how I compose, even, he said, if you can sing it, you can play it. And I think he was just trying to get us to associate pitch with note names and get beyond just root memorization and understanding what it feels like, what it's supposed to sound like. And I never could comprehend that, and it stuck with me. I just couldn't figure out, oh, I can sing it, but I can't play it. Like, because I wasn't familiar with fingerings yet, and I wasn't familiar with a lot of other things yet. But that's how I compose, is like by singing a lot and playing. And when I improvise, I'm also singing in my head as I play it. He was a saxophone, or he is a saxophone player, and jazz player, and he does a lot of improvisation, and that had a lot of impact, I think, on how he educated us.
Borgen Project. Did you know that staff members of congressional leaders' offices often keep a weekly running tally of the issues that their constituents are calling or emailing about? The issues that garner the most attention often lead to leaders following up and co-sponsoring bills. The Borgen Project is a national nonprofit organization that lobbies to end extreme global poverty. Our mission is to make global poverty reduction a focus of U.S. foreign policy, because we all do better when we all do better. You can make a 30-second phone call to your representatives by visiting our website, borgenproject.org. That's BORGEN project.org.
This is 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I am Mike the DJ. The name of my show is The Fluture Is Now, and my guest this week is Nicole Chamberlain. We just heard a piece that is Nicole Chamberlain's composition, Chatter for Two Flutes. We continue now with the interview, after which we'll have more music.
In your compositions, is there room for improvisation, or is improvisation something that you do in other contexts?
It's something I do in other contexts. I find that the audience I'm writing for, the players I'm writing for, are not necessarily always on board with improvisation. Mm-hmm. They like everything spelled out, and I'm fine with that. Now, when I play, that's a different story, but I try to stay to the things on the page, because I think people get upset if, like, the composer is rewriting on stage, and it kind of makes me upset, too. Mm-hmm. But, like, I will improvise in different settings where it's acceptable or where it's expected, but typically in the standard classical world, I guess, for lack of a better term, I don't do that.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What are some of your most memorable musical experiences?
The most recent one, which was a surreal experience, was I played one of my own compositions in front of about every flute hero I had in the audience. Very stressful, exciting. It was at the National Flute Convention last year. And so I was working, it was with the flute speakeasy that Valerie Coleman had formed, and kind of wrangled, she didn't have to wrangle me. All she did was call me, and I was like, I'm whatever it is, I'm doing it. Right. She wrangled me and Amanda Harburg into the mix. And so I played Asphyxia for her and a bunch of my friends that were in the audience, which was nice. But you know, she was there, and I'm trying to make a good impression so that she continues to want to work with me. and Greg Petillo was there. And so there's that other added stress. The person that you learned beatboxing from is sitting right there, mm-hmm. you know? And then, you know, a lot of people that had played that piece were sitting right there, you know, and if the composer can't do a good job, What's the point?
Right.
So it was a high pressure situation. It went well, but it was surreal to have Valerie Coleman sitting right there. You know, I listened to Monty Winn's. They got me through my web design days. Like, I would just put that music on and just try to. And then she was just sitting right there helping me put my music on my stand. It was crazy. Yeah. So, that was probably a very memorable moment. I mean, there's many others. You know, when someone plays your music, it's just very exhilarating. You know, Georgia Symphony played an orchestral piece of mine. That was also a very emotional, surprisingly emotional event. I mean, I wasn't expecting to get, like, I'd been to rehearsals, I'd heard it, but it's just something about that group every time. I've played with that group. And, like, you know, it's always a little precarious in rehearsals, and then whatever, it clicks on performance stage, and it's a wild ride, but it was an amazing performance of it. And Atlanta Opera, watching that, they'd commissioned me to write a children's opera, and they played it, like, 70 times that summer.
Wow.
And so I didn't go to all the performances by any stretch of the imagination, but I went to the very first one, and I went to one in the middle, and then I went to one at the very end, and it was a crazy experience to see how that evolved over a process, how the tempos changed, how the timings changed, how the emphasis on certain phrases changed, the comedy, how it changed. It was, and the audience's reaction to it, how it all evolved. So those, I think, were probably the highlights of the craziest experiences I've had as far as being a musician. Mm-hmm. At least the enjoyable ones. I guess we won't talk about the ones that did not go so well.
Fair enough. You've mentioned before about how you include a lot of extended techniques in your compositions. What is it that sort of got you into that, and what about that draws you into continuing to use those?
And I mean, I think everything that draws me in is to figure it out, like, how is that done? Like, I want to understand how that's done. There's curiosity, I guess, about it. But my composition professor at UGA, Dr. Davis, was pretty... He was really gung-ho. He is gung-ho about extended techniques. He's a fantastic bassoon player who does that as well. And he was pushing it on me all the time in undergrad. And I was like, look, man, I'm just trying to figure out how to write a tune from beginning to end without it making sense. This is a whole nother level of playing I'm not comfortable with yet. I mean, I wasn't even really doing a bunch of it then. I think I was playing Robert Dick's Flying Lessons, but that's about the extent of it. I was just doing some multiphonics, not even touching anything beyond that. And so it wasn't until after I left and was able to feel like I had gotten a job right after college working for a children's multimedia company where you have to keep it pretty commercial and straight laced as far as that is concerned. And so I felt like I got really good at writing there, like writing cohesively. And then once I got out of that job and I was writing more concert music, I started doing that more and developing that. And then that's when I discovered that Greg Petillo was a thing. And then he came to Atlanta and did a workshop. And then things started clicking. Like, he was doing some fantastic things, but obviously I did not write in his style at all, which is probably great. So it wasn't a copycat, but I was like, well, how can I take what he's doing and have it make sense in my style and voice, you know? And so that's the evolution of what happened there. Definitely. And Ian Clark came to Atlanta as well and kind of solidified some more things for me because he did a workshop on the extended techniques he uses in his music, which is fascinating.
I noticed on social media, you and I can't remember her name, but another flutist have been sort of previewing a project that you will have. So I'm interested to see what shape that takes.
Well, I can tell you, since this is probably going to broadcast after the 13th, I imagine, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Dr. Mary Matthews is the flute professor at Tennessee Tech University, and we've collaborated for about 10 years, I guess, now. Mm-hmm. Her name's on a lot of music of mine, whether she premiered it or it was written for her or she commissioned it. I had cold emailed her about 10 years ago about a piece I'd written. She's part of a duo, and they answered and they did it, and that we just hit it off. And so we've just been working together ever since. But she's a fantastic flute player. And every time we work together, I learn something about my playing that I should have learned that I never did. It's always embarrassing and great. But she's a great teacher. She's a fantastic teacher. And she has an interest in extended techniques, new music, and pedagogy. And so we've decided that we would team up and write an etude book on all these extended techniques that we're doing. So I will write all the etudes, and she will be writing the pedagogy or the teaching methods that go with it, since I am not great with words. That has been on my plate to do since before I met her, and I've complained about how I just rather just write tunes and let people figure it out. But she is right that that's not something that I should do, that there's guidance that's needed there, you know? And there's a book lacking. Like, you know, there's pieces of it. Like Greg Patillo wrote a method book on beatboxing, which is fantastic and I highly recommend. But he covers just the beatboxing part, and he goes in depth about it. But for people that want to do something a little more entry level or get into it, we needed something that would focus on one technique one at a time. And so that's the method that we're going to use as far as these techniques. Instead of worrying about what key we're in, as most etudes do, we're going to worry about what extended technique we're utilizing in each one. I hope we feel like there's a need. I mean, Robert Dick wrote an extensive and exhaustive reference book on extended techniques, but there's like a gap we feel that needs to be bridged. And so hopefully this will fill that gap.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. As an amateur flutist, I honestly don't know where to begin with that. And this might be a nice doorway into that world.
Yeah. I mean, because there's fantastic players that do it. And when they do write or talk about it, it's on like this other level that most of us can't. We just want an entry doorway to start. And we're hoping this will get those people there, mainly aimed at maybe upper high school, collegiate, and professionals that have not been formally trained. Because I wasn't, to an extent. It wasn't much of a thing. You know, 25 years ago when I went through school, it was, you know, you had the multiphonics and you had some jet whistles, some key clicks, maybe, but it wasn't as like now in new music, it is in everything. Mm-hmm. And you can't get away from it. So if you want to do new music, you gotta learn how to do it.
Gotcha.
Free children's coats from the Lorain County Community Action Agency. No one in the county should go without a coat if we can help it. Coats are now available to anyone in Lorain County living at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. Go to lccaa.net/programs/operation_warm to complete a coat request. Proof of eligibility will be required. All pickups will be contactless. Parents are encouraged to order the next size up to ensure the coats fit. Questions should be directed to Amy Steele at 440-204-3121 or email her at astee@lccaa.net.
This is 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I am Mike the DJ. The show is The Future Is Now. My guest this week is Nicole Chamberlain. The last piece we heard is a composition by Valerie Coleman entitled Concerto for Wind Quintet, and that movement was entitled Afro. It was performed by the Imani Winds. Back to the interview.
Yeah. What advice would you have for music students?
Is the hardest part of your life. School was so awful for me. I feel like it doesn't have anything to do with talent, but just stubbornness and determination to get through the thing and do all the hoops and jump through all the things. Mm. If you have enough grit to get through music school, you'll have enough grit to do the professional side. But I think that's what makes a good musician is the stubbornness to persevere, even though when you probably shouldn't. Mm. I mean, at least I felt that way about me. Like, this, none of this should have worked. Like, I was struggling. I've never struggled through any subject more than music, but I just wanted it more. And that's some advice I got in high school. It was like, if you want it bad enough, you'll just do the things and figure it out. But, it doesn't really let up as a career musician either. Like, there's still, I don't know. I think there's a different level. I don't know. At least I'm not getting graded on it, but there's not that fear.
Right.
But that's tricky. I think being hard-headed is valuable. I can't really think of any other, just be stubborn and don't feel like you have to take a certain path either. I didn't join an orchestra. I didn't go to get my master's immediately, or I didn't ever. I thought, well, maybe I will, but and in my back of my mind, it's like, I'm not. I'm not. I don't think it's, I mean, I think it's just, you just have to figure out what you want and what you want to do. Listen to the advice, but ultimately, you know what's right for you. So I think it's a level of confidence that sometimes gets beat out of poor students in the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, probably the toughest thing I did was go through music school.
Are there any specific obstacles that you have felt throughout your career?
I mean, every day feels like an obstacle. I mean, it's some days are easier than others, but I think time and money seems to be the biggest obstacle. I mean, I think it depends on the people you surround yourself with. Mm. If you surround yourself with the right people, it gets easier. You know, I have a good spouse that's very supportive. I have friends that I collaborate with and who are supportive. And that has removed a lot of obstacles, just having the right people surround you. But I think as far as everybody else is concerned, I think I had it pretty darn easy. Mm. I don't think I went through a music school where the composition chair was a wholehearted feminist, and he made a point to bring in as many women role models as he could, and, you know, start up a women in music program at the university collaboration with his wife, who was a fantastic historian and musicologist, Dr. Anita Karf. She's a huge impact in helping me with her classes. I had a lot of privilege in how I was able to, you know, I had Hope Scholarship here in Georgia, which meant I went to school for free because mm-hmm. my grade point average was at a certain level. I just had to figure out housing, which my parents were able to provide. Mm-hmm. I had a good job when I got out. I mean, I feel like my obstacles were no more than anybody else as far as that's concerned. I mean, I had annoying things happen. I mean, and I had personal tragedies, but I don't think any of them were insurmountable. They were just, roadblocks more than something I needed to overcome. Gotcha. So I think I had it pretty good, and I can't really complain.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned being surrounded by a good group of people, including mm-hmm. Collaborators. Who are some of your favorite people to collaborate with, and who are some of your favorite musicians, period, that maybe you'd like to collaborate with or just enjoy listening to, or however you want to consider it?
Ooh. Well, I have my, you know, Dr. Matthews is a good one, and Matthew Angelo. We actually had that album 3-9 Line together, mm-hmm. and those people, shenanigans every time. You want to do something? Yeah, sure. What is it? You know, mm-hmm. usually it's like, yeah, I'll collaborate before I even know what the project is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the type of people that you can trust to make good decisions. And have fun doing it. No one's going to get mad at you or have a diva complex. I've worked with Dr. Elizabeth Robinson at Missouri Southern a bazillion times, and she's fantastic. She's a flute player and piccolo player, and I love her to death, and she lives too far away. and those have kind of been my go-tos for collaboration when I need to do something. As far as like people to collaborate with, you know, I hate to think about that kind of thing too much, because sometimes you meet those people and it's not as great as you think it would be. You know, Valerie has been the exception. I mean, we're trying to do stuff together, but I think this pandemic threw a wrench in things, because we're going to do some kind of summer courses together. So that has been a challenge. I mean, I'd love to work with, I mean, Imani Wins would mm-hmm. be fantastic. You know, I think they're amazing people. But I mean, I I'm open to collaborate with whoever is open to collaborate with me. It's not, cast a wide net. I guess I'm not really answering your question.
No, that's fine. That's an answer. who do you like to listen to?
I love Dawn Upshaw a lot. She's my favorite singer. She is too coming to Atlanta, and I've gone to her masterclass because one of the best lessons I ever had in college was with the voice professor, Dr. Broughton. I was playing on a vocalist, Lily Lewis's senior recital, and got to work on this Andre Previn piece with her, and it was a memorable lesson, and I learned a lot about phrasing and air control and just being musical. And I thought, well, I should go to this masterclass because I love her and I should hear what she has to say about being a musician. And it was a fantastic masterclass. And she was playing, I think she was performing Goliath's newest thing at the time. I can't even keep track because she basically has done all of his stuff. And Atlanta performed all of his things. But that would be someone I listen to as well. I listen to a lot of Atlanta Symphony music. That has been, Christina Smith was one of my teachers after school. I think she's also another amazing teacher and player. Mm-hmm. So I listen to that group a lot. And because I'm married to a guitarist, I listen to guitarists a lot. So like LA Guitar Quartet. It's another one. But that's a lot of what I listen to, and I listen when I'm just kind of off work. I listen to a lot of standards and big band music from the 40s, recordings from the 40s, I don't necessarily enjoy the modern interpretations yet. Maybe I will, but I listen to a lot of that.
Right, gotcha.
Thank you.
This is 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I am Mike the DJ. The name of the show is The Future Is Now, where I have music from and interviews with some of the best flute players around these days. That last piece was a piece that was composed by Dr. William Davis, who was Nicole Chamberlain's composition professor, and one of her flute professors, Dr. Ronald Walm, was the flutist on it. The name of the piece is Of the Georgia Night Winds Telling, and that movement was entitled The Iron Horse. We're going to close up with the interview with Nicole directly.
How has COVID affected what you're doing, and do you think that it will have a impact as things get resolved and as time marches on and the music's future in general? So
yeah, I mean, it's gonna, for me personally, I have all of my performances got canceled, with exception of one crazy Nutcracker, which I'm not gonna do. So everything got canceled. So I haven't been performing. I haven't been traveling. I haven't been doing the physical networking like I usually do when I traveled, all these things. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of my premieres canceled this year. So one of them was in Japan, which I was looking forward to. Mm. And that was like the very first week where everything locked down. And I was just, and just yesterday or the day before, I found out the bassoon concerto that I finished writing will be postponed for another year, which I'm relieved about. I mean, I finished it, but I'm relieved that I don't have to tell them I'm not coming. Because performance in February in Iowa wasn't looking good for health reasons. So personally, that's how that's affected me. I'm starting to see my commission queue has dropped off. So my last commission deadline is in January, and usually I have things stacked up for 6 months. So I think I'm going to find myself in January with a lot of writing free time, which will be new and different, so I can get that book done. but professionally as a whole, I think it's certainly going to take a while to get back. The comfort level of an audience coming to something like that might take a little bit. But, you know, again, if everything starts opening back up like May and June, by the time concert season starts back up again, hopefully people will have been more comfortable by then. Mm-hmm. So there may be, it can happen two ways, where no one shows up because no one's comfortable, or everybody shows up because they're just so elated to be at concerts again and to perform. A lot of orchestras and other performance ensembles have taken a hit and closed. Mm. It may affect them financially for a while, which usually will affect new music first, mm-hmm. because it's not the moneymaker. Mm-hmm. It's usually the standards that are the moneymaker, like your Beethovens and your Mozarts and all of that. So it may take a time for the new music to kind of rebound. So composers kind of the last to feel the effects, because I had all my contracts agreed upon mm-hmm. by the time this really hit. So I had been working pretty solid up until January will be when things drop off. But then things will open up. And so hopefully I won't have to wait too long before people decide to commission again. Mm-hmm. But we all kind of joke, the composers, saying that like there's going to be so many pieces written about the pandemic.
Yeah,
you know, and there's even a time where flute was called the super spreader, and so I had threatened to write a piece called the super spreader. But I don't know.
Maybe that could be a companion piece for your piccolo piece, the death whistle.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I get a little cringy when people talk about the death whistle right now.
Okay, sorry.
No, only because, you know, only in that context. Right. But it was meant to be, you know, a humorous piece and ridiculous. Right. But yeah, the same with asphyxia. I mean, I get a little like, So anyway, you know, and I look towards other composers that lived through the pandemic, you know, the Spanish flu pandemic, and like Igor Stravinsky, he was no help. His autobiography was no help, by the way. He just skips over that year. Doesn't really talk about it. Says, oh, and then everybody got sick. And then this happened. So I kind of stopped reading that book because it made me mad.
Now, one thing that I know you from is from your Twitch channel. So is that something that you did in response to the pandemic?
No, I oddly did that before.
Okay.
I used it as a tool to, because I practiced last, I wasn't practicing as often as I should to prepare for a tour that I was doing last November. So I basically was gone all of November. I went to a plethora of places performing a few concerts of my own stuff. And so I had kind of saw it as a peer pressure tool that I would just practice those things. And that's what I did. And my husband didn't even know I was Twitching. He had been doing gaming Twitching for a long time, and I had not. And so I started using it for that, and it was very effective. Like, I was doing really focused, detailed practicing for that. And then when I got back from the tour, I used it to get back up on Nutcracker again. And now I have switched to using it so that my anxiety for performing for others stays under control. Because I usually do it. I play at a church every week, and that keeps my management of my nerves at bay. And I've been worried since I haven't done anything that would be the case again. So that has helped me, even if I'm just practicing or just being silly and playing whatever tunes. It's kind of helped with that and helped me stay a performer.
Well, as a student myself, it's really interesting. It's interesting to see the process that you go through in your practice. It's interesting to see that you don't seem to have any judgment or prejudice about what you play. I mean, one of my favorites is the Pokemon theme that you play. and that would be maybe the last thing that I would expect someone, you know, with your background to play, but it's still a lot of fun, you know.
I think, and the thing about going through music school and everything, there's a point where you start to lose joy in performing. Mm-hmm. And that would happen to me quite a bit. My students kind of keep me joyful, you know, where they want to learn something. And so we just do it. And there's value in all music. And whether it makes you feel silly or you just love it seriously, and that's kind of the point of the Twitch stream, is to maintain, not only keep my anxieties of playing in front of people at bay, but also make sure I still understand why I'm practicing. Mm-hmm. You know, is because it, at one point in my life, I loved doing it just to play, not because it was a paycheck. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of, it's easy to lose that focus once you go through music school and you do it as a everyday job. So Twitch has helped kind of reunite that joy again of playing. Mm-hmm. Especially when you're just alone. Yeah. This is the worst. Yeah.
Do you have any other interests besides music?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I have two dogs. They're mm-hmm. kind of my main focus. So, you know, they're a daily thing I have to do. They make sure I get outside every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, my digital media degree required art. And so something I've been trying to do again is doodle. It's something I haven't been doing a lot of. I'm terrible at it. Just so terrible at it. Mm-hmm. But music takes up the most of it. I think mm-hmm. anybody who works for themselves understands how, like, you know, yeah, sure, you love what you do, but you do it all the time.
Right, right.
So, definitely. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for your time. It was a very interesting, fascinating, gracious interview. Do you have any parting words for my audience?
Not really. Thanks for having me on. I did Twitch to just reach a different audience. It's so funny that here I am, I found a flute player who has a radio show through all of it. So it's been an amazing experience to meet a different group of people who I never would have met in the first place if it hadn't been for technology. So,
right. Yeah. You know, I keep coming back to that there's a lot of people, I've interviewed people that were in Austria, in Japan, you know, and all that, and the thing that I keep getting back to is, like, I would just want to do this anyhow, even if it wasn't a radio show, just find people that I admire and that are inspirational and that I love their work and just sit down with them for a half hour and chat with them. It's like, I feel like I'm somehow cheating and then I'm turning it into a radio show as an excuse, you know. But everyone has been so cordial and, responding to my, you know, in your case, you know, I was a little somewhat familiar with you before this, but in some cases, people that literally I've never met or had any content. Hey, would you like to do my radio show? And most of them, like, yeah, sure. Why not?
You know? I think flute players are a pretty friendly bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, very social, want to talk to you. It's the best when if you ever go to a local flute fair, a flute convention, like, it's really easy to strike up conversation with people. You have something in common with them and people are pretty, for the most part, outgoing. I mean, some people are a little more reserved, but, for the most part. And I think going back to your question about the pandemic, how it might change, I think people's comfort level with technology and communicating this way via video chats and things, I think that's going to make everybody a little more easy to get in touch with.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much again, and take care. I'll let you know when this is going to air.
This is 91.5 FM, WOBC, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I am Mike the DJ. The name of my show is The Future Is Now, and my very special guest this week was Nicole Chamberlain. In upcoming weeks, I'm going to have a lot more great interviews. I hope you tune in. I hope you enjoy it. Please let me know if you have any feedback concerning the show, or if you want more information about the show, including archives of past shows. You can go and look at Facebook, and you can see there's a page for The Future Is Now, the show. Simply do a search for The Future Is Now, and it'll be the first thing that shows up. So, I hope you enjoyed this interview. Nicole Chamberlain is an amazing musician, both a flute player and a composer. Next week, well, I like keeping things surprises. I don't like to reveal my hand too soon. As the great philosopher Kenneth Rogers once said, you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, and know when to run. Too bad he didn't play flute. We could have possibly included that on one of our shows. At any rate, next week we will have another interview. And until then, I hope you're having a great winter semester, winter term. I believe they call it in Oberlin. I teach at a local community college, and it's our spring semester. It sure doesn't feel like spring, but alas, here we are in spring semester. So again, this is 91.5 FM, WOBC, Oberlin College and Community Radio. Until next week, happy fluting, enjoy yourself, and by all other means that you can, take care of yourself. This is Mike, signing off. Until next week, take care and happy fluting. Goodbye.